On today's episode of The Good Word, Scott Perry joins us to discuss the Lakers, the Nuggets, and more. Should they be looking to make moves at the trade deadline approaches? We talk about his days as an executive making hard trades, and we talk about Adam Silver admitting the three-point line has been overemphasized in today's game. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. A couple of bits of business before we get into today. If you haven't already, please check out The Good Word with Goodwill on YouTube. And wherever you get your podcast, please rate us and review us. Give us a five-star review. Today, we are joined by my man, Scott Perry. Scott Perry was most recently the general manager of the New York Knicks, over three decades of front office experience in the NBA. And of course, he also was a college coach. So Scott has a wealth of NBA basketball, just overall life experience. When he was the assistant general manager of the Detroit Pistons, he would often give me a call and tell me what I was doing wrong on the beat, which led me to believe that he could be a beat writer too. What's going on, Scott? How you doing?
Man, I'm great, Vinny. You know, the intro was great, but I knew I was just waiting for that moment where you're going to give me that little dig when I used to get on you or something like that. So I thought I had cleared that, but hey, it wouldn't be the same without that, Vinny. Great to be here, man. And so proud of you and what you're doing in this space, and just happy to be on and
Scott, talk you a little ball with me. You look, there's certain people that help raise you in this business, so you're always going to give them a little nudge or two. But man, yeah. I really wanted you on today, not because it's MLK Day, but you know that just happens to be what it is. But also, Scott, the fact that the trade deadline is a couple of weeks away, I want to run through some teams with you to see exactly where you sit on them from your front office perspective. Tell me about the discussions that happen when teams are at this almost crossroads spot. I feel like there's teams that can, you know, that can make a move to, you know, elevate themselves and put themselves in a better position, maybe sacrifice from future, take a chance. And there's other teams that I'm looking at and I'm saying maybe they should decide to take a step back and recalibrate where they are. And if we have time, maybe we'll get on the Philadelphia 76ers and their mess. But Scott, you can set your clock to it.
Okay.
The Lakers will have a bad loss. It is January, and LeBron James will take the mic and he will say, you know, we don't have a lot of margin for error because of the way that we are constructed. That is a shot to the front office, if there ever was. That's a subtle shot. If you are LeBron James, he's normally a little bit more passive-aggressive on the passive-aggressive scale. But, Scott, look at their point differential. They're minus 2.1 points a game. LeBron is, of course, 40 years old. Anthony Davis has been battling the foot. There's still a few games over 500. They're still in the top six of the Western Conference. They don't have a lot of flexibility, but they have future draft picks that they can conceivably move in the future for a impact player. If you were Rob Pelinka and those guys in the front office, would you be looking at this team and saying, and be telling yourself and telling everybody, we need to make a move for another impact player with the limited resources we have? Or do we need to stand pat because we don't have resources and we have to look at our future and not just sacrifice it for right now?
Well, here's the thing, Benny. First of all, I believe Rob Pelinka has started this process because just a few weeks ago, they went out and picked up
Dorian Finney-Smith.
Traded down for Dorian Finney-Smith. So I like that pickup, to be honest with you. I thought that they needed, it was a team in need of improving their perimeter defense. He brings that. Now, when you talk about going to get another impact player, the issue becomes this. This is a first apron team, and they're not going to be able to do it just putting draft picks on the table. They're going to have to get a player who's an impact player. His salary, more than likely, is going to be a larger one. If he's an impact player on a rookie scale deal, those teams aren't trading those guys anyway. So you're looking for an experienced player who's probably going to be making in excess of $20 million, that means you're going to have to trade one of your good players on your team. Obviously, that's not LeBron James or Anthony Davis. And they've been unwilling to, you know, they're not going to move Austin Reeves. At least they've been unwilling to do that to this point. So that is where they're, I don't say stuck at right now, but that is the conundrum that they're in right now. Unless you're going to move him and or Rui Hachimura to get some kind of more established veteran player, I don't know what the Lakers can do now, because I thought the most important move was getting Finney Smith, because that was going to help the team. They still have Jared Vanderbilt, a guy who, if they can get him healthy, who can help them defensively. And those kind of guys can help this team navigate the rest of the regular season, because they can bring the energy and the defensive prowess that's necessary to back up a 40-year-old LeBron James and a guy like Anthony Davis who's often injured. So that's kind of how I size up the Lakers right now.
Now, Scott, because a lot of us don't know how these discussions happen internally, we always think of a front office being of one mind, the coach being of one mind or whatever. But when you have different voices inside the room and different agendas to go through, how do you handle and navigate those conversations internally? Is it a lot of arguments? Are there a lot of, is it text threads? Is it, I know a lot of teams have their sort of mid-season meetings where everybody sort of comes and gets together, the scouts fly in, and stuff like that. How do you navigate those huge discussions that the public doesn't get to see? I don't think it's like a kumbaya thing. I feel like it's a lot of heated discussions where different, you know, viewpoints are taking place and then someone has to make a decision.
No question about it. But these discussions really start at the beginning of the year. They go back to training camp. You're not just starting to have these heated discussions 3 weeks away from the trade deadline. It's important to me, at least for me, if you're going to be real organized in this process, you're continually talking about your team, looking at your team in the current, and then forecasting what you need to do in the future. And so I used to have biweekly meetings with scouting staff, and you always are talking about, you know, what players are available, monitoring who's playing well around the league, assigning different people on your staff to talk to other teams about trade possibilities, who could be available, who may not be available. And you're continually vetting these things out all the time. So that's what you're doing. If you manage it throughout the process, those heated discussions become very productive as you get closer to it. If you're not managing along the way, Vinny, then it can become problematic, because what happens is, and it can be human nature, well, I wanted us to go after this guy, but the GM didn't want to, or this scout said this in the meeting. And that's the furthest thing that you need, is people to become frayed during this time. You need a concerted effort. I used to use this phrase. I want diversity of thought, but with unity of purpose. And as leadership, you have to set that tone with your entire staff, not only the scouting staff, but your coaches as well, because you're always constantly talking to your coaches too, because they are working with these players daily. They are more privy to maybe some conversations or some idiosyncrasies of the player inside the locker room, for sure, before we are, and maybe unbeknownst
coaches,
to us as well.
Because coaches talk to coaches.
Absolutely.
Throughout the league.
Absolutely.
So here's a player, because it's going to help me transition to the next team. But I'm asking you, this player, you may say no for the Lakers and yes for this next team. If you're the Lakers, do you put Hachimura, Austin Reeves, maybe those two first-round draft picks? I think you got them 20, 30, and 32, or 28 and 32, whatever it is. Do you call the Chicago Bulls and say, all right, cool, we're going to take on Zach LaVine and his long money and his ability to stretch the floor, create easy shot opportunities, and to be a certified third scorer next to LeBron and AD? Of course, the clutch sports connection, because he's represented by Rich Paul. Would you look at him, if you're the Lakers, and saying, you know what, he's a player that elevates us to where Oklahoma City is, and theoretically where Houston is, because they're second in the West? Do you see this as an opportunity for them with that player?
Here's the conversation you have. Obviously, he's worthy of a conversation, internal conversation and debate, of what you're talking about, because we're talking about an extremely talented scorer. What the issue becomes is, and you got to ask yourself if you're Rob Pelinka, is if this move makes us a champion. You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
This has got, you got to be convinced, because what you're doing is what you're sacrificing some of your future, because you're giving away two good young players. They may not be the star level talent of Zach LaVine, but also they have a longevity to them. They have a consistency to them. You know, Zach has had a lot of injuries throughout the course of his career. I think going to the Lakers is probably a better fit for Zach in that he doesn't have the pressure of being the number one or two guy.
Right.
You know, and that could be helpful and beneficial to the team now. But you shrink your depth a little bit too, because now you're trading out two players who are very productive for you for just one. So that's how I would do it if I was the Lakers looking at it. I don't know that it, ultimately when I would make that decision or looking at it from afar, because I'm not in the locker room, so I'm a little hesitant to weigh in super strongly. But from the outside looking in, I don't know that that move makes the Lakers the favorite to beat the Oklahoma City Thunder, or even for that matter, you know, surpass the Houston Rockets right now, or even Memphis Grizzlies, because those are your top three teams. So, but it is definitely worthy of discussion, but I'm not sure that that says, okay, we're a champion. Because if it fails, then where do you go? Because like I said, LeBron has less years left than Moore.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
And Zach has an exorbitant salary, a very high salary. Where do you go with this team from there? And so I would be worried about that from a health and longevity standpoint. So ultimately, I probably would not look in that direction if I had to give up those two guys. The draft picks, I'm okay with giving the draft picks up. But giving those two players up, given all of the circumstance, that would be a little concerning for me.
Okay, so Scott, I will transition. If you're the Denver Nuggets, and that's a team that struggled early to start the season, right? Mm-hmm. And now I think they're 10-3 in their last 13. Jokic and Russell Westbrook, who you know well, has found a lot of synergy together. A lot of people thought Russell Westbrook was done, me being included. They have found something together. Russ respects Jokic and plays hard.
No question.
You're the Denver Nuggets, put it like this. Not if you would go and get Zach LaVine. We can talk about that. But if you are the Denver Nuggets and you're looking at what we've done recently, we won 10 out of 13. We're now fourth in the West. We feel a lot better about ourselves and where we are right now. Is that a big enough sample size for you to say, let's not tinker with it because we got Aaron Gordon coming back. Maybe Jamal Murray's turning the corner. Is that enough to make you believe in what they're doing? Or are you still looking at it and saying, maybe we need to tinker with what we have because this isn't enough?
Well, a couple things as I assess that situation. First of all, you're talking about a team that's a recent champion, and they have a guy that's three-time MVP and arguably could be the four-time MVP, even though I believe Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is my early leader in the clubhouse for that. But so they know what it takes to win a championship. And when the year that they won it, that offseason, when they lost Jeff Green and Bruce Brown, I really thought that was problematic because depth, and you know this about me, Vinny, especially covering our Pistons teams during the year, how important depth was, not only through your run through the regular season, but being able to show up to come playoff time in key moments. And so that was always my biggest question about this Nuggets group last season and leading into this season. Now, to your point, Russell Westbrook is playing outstanding. Look, he's a tremendous competitor. So I'm not totally shocked by it because this guy's going to always lay it on the line. And I believe being paired up with Nikola Jokic, someone he has great respect for and what he's accomplished, has made him easier made it easier for Russ to be more accepting of the kind of role that he's playing right now. So you're getting the best version of him in the later stages of his career. If Aaron Gordon can get back healthy, who I know very well, we drafted him at the Magic, and he was a key piece to that championship team, and Jamal Murray can turn it around, I think they can be right there. I still would like to see them some kind of way add another role player, another bench player that could that has some veteran chops that could come in a series, you know, be their eighth or ninth man and make some key plays, stops defensively, make big shots, not afraid of the moment, add some toughness. They may be just one player away from again winning it all. I still think they'll have a chance, but I'd like to see them just get, again, another a role player. It doesn't have to be somebody like a Zach LaVine.
Right.
Again, you've got the best, arguably the best player in the world on your team, and everybody else is playing off. So somebody's got to be able to fit into that group. See, a lot of times we don't talk about that enough, about the fit, and I think we'll get into it some more when we talk about these other teams and what they need to do. But fit is so huge and so important, and a lot of times is not regarded high enough in the discourse when we start talking about trades.
Yeah, no, I think my argument, and I agree with you, if I'm Denver's front office, I'm a little more aggressive than I am with if I'm the Lakers front office, because I think you have to be a lot more sober about a player like Zach. The thing that attracts me about a guy like Zach, if I were Denver, is, as we saw in the playoffs last year against Minnesota, that Jokic wore down throughout the course of that series, because you had Karl Towns beating them up and Rudy Gobert and Naz Reid. Like, he didn't catch a break. And sometimes there needs to be a guy who has irrational confidence, who believes that in a moment he's better than everybody else on the floor, even though he's nowhere near the best player on the floor. Even if he's the second or third best player on the floor, he can steal you a game. He can carry you for a quarter, go on a heater like that. That, to me, is like Zach LaVine. And I think there comes a point where financial, I think people's reputations become a little bit outsized in a negative way. And you start, and you stop looking at the basketball player. And you start looking at the number. And I think that's where Zach is. And I feel like now, if you're the Bulls, and we'll talk to about the Bulls later in depth, I'm very weary of reputation exceeding basketball player. You went through that with Rasheed Wallace, and you guys made, you guys took the chance on Rasheed. You had a defined set space, and boom, you went from a team that was near the top of the Eastern Conference to making a huge leap and going to the NBA Finals and winning it and going back the next season. So, Scott, with that said, the Phoenix Suns is my next team.
Okay.
They're right at 500.
Second apron team, too. So make
they're second apron team. So when people hear second apron, what that means, guys, is you're very limited in what you can do. You cannot take in more money than what you brought in. You cannot aggregate players for trades, which means you can't trade Bradley Beal plus this for one guy. It has to be even. So it's very restrictive in what you can do. But that being said, Scott, we all know they want Jimmy Butler. We all know that Bradley Beal doesn't want to give up his no trade clause, one of the most valuable tools a player can have, maybe the most valuable tool a player can have, which is why there's only two in the NBA, Bradley Beal and LeBron James.
No question.
They acquired Nick Richards last week in a minor trade, but
that's I like that.
I was going to ask you, is that the type of deal where it's minor, but it's enough for them because you have the frontline talent in at least KD and Book, and you need to operate just around like the edges?
Yeah, it's, and plus it's realistic. See, you got to add people who are willing to do some of the dirty work and do, and play some of the do some of the role things that maybe KD, Devin Booker, or Bradley Beal, you're not asking them to do, because you're asking them to shoulder a much higher responsibility in terms of scoring every night and being efficient offensively and leading that charge. So I like that move, going to explore a guy like Nick Richards. I think he's a good backup center, plays hard, will rebound his position, will defend on the interior, gives you six additional fouls at that position. So I like that. See, the idea of going after Jimmy Butler. Again, a lot of times we talk about, when we talk about trades, we see the names and the stars, and we put all these star names together. But look, they got three huge star names right there, right now, in terms of Beal, Booker, Durant. Doesn't always mean that they're going to fit and work together in the best way. On paper, they look great because they're all the phenomenal players in their own right and all very accomplished. So, okay, let's say you want to trade out Bradley Beal. Let's say he agreed to do that and Miami wanted Bradley Beal.
Right.
And they were to do a one, and because that's the other big part of consummating the trade. The other team's got to want who you're going to send back. And Bradley Beal has lost a lot of time due to injury here over the last 4 or 5 years, which we know in Miami, that doesn't sit well probably. Because right. Miami wants, they want to get somebody back who is available consistently and put their hand in the pile and push the Heat culture, if you will, towards winning. But you get Jimmy Butler into Phoenix. Again, Jimmy Butler, done a lot in his league, tough player, competitor. But does he fit in the locker room? Again, I'm not there. Does right. that mean that all of a sudden, okay, oh, we got Jimmy Butler, Phoenix ascends to the top of the Western Conference? I don't believe, because you, again, you got to talk about the human element and the human fit there. And so I'm not so sure, because if Jimmy Butler is disgruntled with Miami, and look, I believe this is all over money because he didn't yes. get his extension and yes. all of those kind of things. And if Phoenix is saying, oh, but we'll pay, we'll extend him and pay him all that money. If I'm Phoenix, is that the responsible thing really to do? Again, we talked about this earlier with the Lakers. Does Jimmy Butler going there put you as an odds-on favorite to win the NBA championship? I don't believe so. Jimmy Butler's 36 now. Again, he's still a very good player, but you're getting a player more on the back end of his career than on the front end of it. And I know people say, oh, well, you know, LeBron is 40. Well, LeBron is an anomaly.
Yeah, right.
He's playing as great as he is at 40 years old. Jimmy Butler came up through the system a lot different, extremely hard worker, wasn't the natural talent of a LeBron James either. So as a guy like Jimmy Butler ages and gets older, where, you know, so much of his game relied on toughness, grit, energy, he doesn't have the, you know, he's still not 6'9", 260, and
right.
race up down the court, all kind of court vision, just his entire feel and IQ for the game, a little different player. It's no disrespect to Jimmy Butler, but you're comparing Jimmy Butler to one of the all-time greats in LeBron James. If I'm Phoenix, I'm going to see if I can do maybe another move or two like the Nick Richards deal. And then on the second part of that, though, I will say this. I don't know that the Bradley Beal, Devin Booker, Kevin Durant trio, though, is good enough to get you a championship.
Unless
you get another couple of role players or two, because look, there's no point guard in the group. I know they've added Tyus Jones, but look, you need those three. You know, if those three players are going to be on the floor, there's not a point guard between Devin and
Brad.
So then, if you add Tyus to the mix, you're playing the three of them. You're very small on the perimeter, and then you got KD. Then you push. You know, he's playing the four. So you're smallest, you're lightest, you're not very physical. So some of the more physical teams that you may face in the playoffs are going to be very problematic for you too. And teams would have size on the perimeter. So that's how I look at that situation there. They're in a tough quandary because they pushed all the chips to the table. And I'm never against a team doing that if they believe in that. But now that they've done that, you kind of limited in that space.
They're paying the bill on it.
That's a good way to put it.
They're paying the bill on it. When we come back, look, this second apron stuff, it's a conversation for another day. the players put themselves in a terrible position in this collective bargaining agreement. I don't think they knew exactly what they were getting themselves into. That's going to be a topic for discussion for another day. But when we come back, we just talked about the Western Conference. We're going to talk about the Eastern Conference and a few of the intriguing teams over there with Scott Perry. Listen to the good word here on Yahoo Sports. Back here on The Good Word with Scott Perry, Scott P., a team, a franchise, a city that you know very, very well. The Detroit Pistons, they are now 500. A couple days ago, they were two games over 500. For the first time in almost 6 years, over 6 years, since the Blake Griffin, Reggie Jackson, Andre Drummond years, it's been a rough time in Detroit. I've chronicled it here. Kay Cunningham has elevated himself. J.B. Bickerstaff is firmly in the coach of the year conversation. Trajan Langdon leading that front office. They lost Jaden Ivey a couple of weeks ago to that gruesome leg injury. And I don't know if he's going to make it back this season. But them being at 500 and them having cap space, Scott, do you look at them and say, you guys should capitalize on the momentum that you have as a franchise right now and make a move for right now? Or do you say, let's stay dedicated to the long-term plan. Let's see how these young guys develop this year. We'll probably get into the playoffs if we don't do anything anywhere, at least the play-in. How do you view this team this season juxtaposing the present versus the future?
Great question. First of all, let me start with the great improvement of Cade Cunningham. I'm starting to see a guy now take on some real leadership responsibilities in how he plays and how he interacts with the team and just how he shows up on a nightly basis. So you know you have something in him now that you can truly build around moving forward. And that's an important thing to know. Unfortunate on the Jaden Ivey injury, because I was a huge fan of his. I am a huge fan of his. Superior athlete. Just wishing him a great recovery and that he gets back to the level that he was playing at and continues to improve beyond that. But if you're sitting with the Pistons right now, they have to this point far exceeded anybody's expectations, I believe, in the basketball world, given that they were the worst team in the basketball last year in terms of record. And you mentioned the job that J.B. Bickerstaff has done. His energy and presence alone has really changed the whole outlook of the team as I watch the team now. So kudos to him. He's doing a fantastic job. So with that, the most important thing you can do as an organization now is you've got to protect the sanctity of that locker room. What do I mean by that? It's obvious that the locker room, there's some very good chemistry that's going on. There's a culture developing. The veterans that were brought in, like Tobias Harris, who I had in Orlando, who I know to be a true professional, good guy, hard worker, who had a previous run in Detroit. Tim Hardaway, another player I had close experience with in New York. Another hardworking, competitive guy, professional, goes about. He understands how to prepare himself to play an NBA basketball game. Not as familiar with Malik Beasley on a personal level. But those additions this year, along with the growth and development of the young guys, has allowed this team to be competitive in just about every game they played this season. So, yes, do you have to survey the landscape and see what may be available to you come trade deadline? Absolutely. It would be not prudent if you weren't doing that. However, to me, you got to be very cautious in that because, again, you know, because I read somewhere, oh, they need to go after Jimmy Butler. Well, I don't know that you want to bring Jimmy Butler's personality into that locker room now, right now.
Yeah.
It doesn't make that kind of sense. So see where this group can go, how they keep growing and developing. You mentioned it earlier, you got money coming into this offseason. And if you're a playoff team, you can become a player. Even if they missed the playoffs, let's say they lost in the play-in or something like that. Basketball people see them trending upward. They will have the ability, because they're going to have money too, that, okay, this thing is starting to turn around. So players that are going hitting the free agent market that could help fill in and complement Cade Cunningham, Jaden Ivey, and Jalen Duren. And let's not forget Asua Thompson.
Yeah.
They've got some terrific young players there. You got to give some credit. You know, even though the team has struggled the last few years and been bad for a variety of reasons, got to give former GM Troy Weaver some props for some of the guys that he's drafted and was left behind on this roster, because these are going to be the guys that are building this team moving forward.
Yeah, it's not an empty cover by any stretch. I just think when you talk about Troy, who you know very, very well, you know, you've had a longstanding relationship with Troy. It's less about the draft picks that you make. It's more about how you've augmented. You've talked about the veterans on that team, Tobias Harris and Malik Beasley and Tim Hardaway Jr. You can't leave those kids out there by themselves.
No.
And I think that was the mistake that was made. We could talk about the Monty Williams hiring and everything else.
Yeah.
And Scott, not to be funny about it, the Detroit Pistons owe someone a draft pick. And they owe someone a draft pick because of a trade that Troy Weaver made with you a couple years ago to get Jalen Duren. Like, you are the reason the Pistons are not going all in on any other player, because they owe a draft pick. So I'm sure on behalf of, you know, Piston fans everywhere, I'm sure they will say thank you to Scott Perry for having Owen a draft pick. They greatly appreciate you, Scott.
You just brought it, just jarred my memory a little bit about that deal.
But it's funny. I thought about this, and maybe forgive me for not asking about this earlier. I look at the Philadelphia 76ers.
Okay.
They've lost six straight games.
Mm-hmm.
Joel Embiid, we got another injury update from him last week, right? Where he's going to miss another couple of weeks because, you know, foot injuries and everything else. Scott, just in general, is this a Daryl Morey chemistry experiment that has just gone wrong? The whole thing, signing Paul George, investing in Joel Embiid the way that you're investing in him because of the way that his body has failed him, despite the fact that he is the type of productive player that he is. Like, is this just from a front office perspective, this is just a disaster?
It's not good. I can't sugarcoat it. I got to agree with this. It's not good at all. And what you mentioned, and look, these jobs are tough. I know that personally. And this is no disrespect to Daryl Morey, who has been a longtime executive and has had, you know, some winning teams that he's been involved with at Houston and in Philadelphia as well. They haven't gone the full distance.
Right.
But they've won a lot of regular season basketball games and some playoff games. But when you analyze this, okay, you've got Joel Embiid, who, when healthy, is arguably the most talented center in the league. And I know we talked about how great Nikola Jokic is, but part of his greatness is he's always available too.
Yep,
and he plays the full game. And that has been the biggest knock on Joel Embiid his entire career, is his lack of availability. And that is one of the, if not the top ability for any player, is to, you know, be injury free as much as possible and be available for 82 games. That's what these guys are under contract for, to play is for 82 games plus playoffs if you're on a good enough team. So you know that about him. And then you go get Paul George, very talented player who I like, but in the previous 3-4 seasons at least, he missed more games than Joel Embiid, I believe. And so to go give him that type of money as well, with his injury history, and he's, 34 years old right now?
Yeah.
You really were rolling the dice. Again, I never fault anybody for saying, okay, let me just take a chance to go ahead and try to win it. However, there's certain such things as gambles and risk. You know, there's a little bit of different there. You know, a gamble, you just gambling, you don't even have the information. But a risk, usually you have some information when you decide I'm going to take this risk. And having that information of all this injury history, to me, made this, you know, decision to go pay Paul George all that money, one that leaves itself open to a lot of question. Mm-hmm. And I was one that didn't think it was going to take the Philadelphia Sixers and put them into the top of the Eastern Conference because of the lack of availability. I love Tyrese Maxey. I think he's a great young player. But really, he's the only one standing there right now.
Yeah,
of those three each and every night. And he, early in the year, had missed a few games, which was uncharacteristic for him. But I don't see how Philly truly recovers from this, to be honest with you. I don't.
Scott, would you trade Joel Embiid? If you could, he's got 4 years left on his deal. He's got a player option in 28-29 for a whopping $67 million.
Mm-hmm.
If you were the Philadelphia 76ers right now, would you say, it's time to pull the plug here? It is time to trade Joel Embiid, whether it's this offseason or whatever it is, because this is not working. He's 30 years old. It doesn't seem like it.
Right.
But he's 30 years old, Scott.
Mm-hmm.
And big man with that type of atrophy, the back injuries, the knee injury, you know, the foot injuries, you know, maybe not knee, foot injuries. You know, he did have a knee last year. He had a knee procedure right before the playoffs. With those type of lower leg injuries, that does not bode well long term. So if you could find a taker that could give you something
and that's the key. You said it. If you could find a taker.
Exactly. Yeah. Would you? Would you seriously consider it? Or would you say, we've invested too much in him, he's invested too much in us, we just have to ride this out?
And this is what makes the jobs difficult. Because obviously, to your last point there, there's been a great investment both ways. Team to player, player to team in the community. So that weighs heavily when you go through your thought process. With that being said, and we know this, the business that we're in, I think you have to look at it and explore it to at least see how much you could possibly get in return and what you think you could possibly get in return, because that, it, you know, keep you at minimum where you're at now. I mean, when I say you're at, I'm considering them a playoff team eventually, because that's what they've been, and a team that could go from that point and grow, even without that superstar of Joel Embiid. But you've got to, if you're doing this thing responsibly, you've got to at least, in my opinion, be exploring and finding out quietly as you can of what kind of value that you could get in return to weigh that. Because look, we wouldn't even be having this conversation if Joel Embiid didn't have a rich injury history. It wouldn't even be a conversation. And if he didn't have it, more than likely Philadelphia would have been in the conference final or two by now, if not in the final. So that is the reality of it. And something we got to take take our emotions out of it and then do our jobs. It's no disrespect to Joel Embiid, what I'm saying. I love his game and love his talent. And he is a monster to compete against when he's available. But unfortunately, he just hadn't been available. And I think Daryl Morey and that Philadelphia organization has to start looking and asking questions in this regard.
Now, Scott, I'm not going to have you answer the question now, but I want you to put this in the back of your head as we go to the next segment.
Okay.
I want you to think of the hardest trade you had to make. Don't tell me now. I'm just giving you some time to marinate on it. The hardest trade that you had, that you were a part of, that you had to make. Don't give me the answer now, because when we come back from the break, I know we're going to talk about the Bulls and the Bucks, but I felt like the 76ers conversation was a little more prudent. But when we come back, we're going to talk about the last word. Adam Silver has some interesting comments. I want to get Scott's reaction on that. Listen to The Good Word on Yahoo Sports. Back here on The Good Word with Goodwill here with Scott Perry, Scott P. Adam Silver went on Colin Cowherd's show, I think it was last week.
Mm-hmm.
And Cowherd asked him about the overemphasis of the three-point shot. And for the first time, it seemed like Adam publicly is saying, you know what? maybe the pendulum has swung too much in that direction. And Kyle Hurd said, maybe we should pull the line back, eliminate the corner threes, bring Hanček back. And Adam says, if we do that, then what winds up happening is you have Victor Wembanyama, a very diverse offensive player who can do a lot of different things. You have him planted in the lane, and that's not very aesthetically pleasing for basketball in the future. Now, the question I have to you, Scott, is, A, are you surprised that that's where Adam sits now finally on, oh, man, this three-point shot has way too much value in today's game, and the game looks too homogenous? Mm-hmm. And B, do you believe that any one or two rule changes would balance the game back towards a more diverse way of play?
First of all, Adam is responding to the ratings and the reality of the business right now. Ratings are down in terms of television viewership of the NBA. And he's hearing a lot of the reasons why is because of, like, you, to your point, this homogenous style of play, this over-dependence on three-point shooting, everybody talking about, oh, it's the math and all of these kind of things. And there's, look, you had two games this year with the same two participants, Chicago.
Bulls and Hornets.
Yep. Bulls and Hornets. They combined to miss 75 three-point shots. Now, Benny, I could go to Rec Center in Detroit and watch that for free. They missed 75. People are trying to, they want to see professional basketball. And they're not trying to see 75 missed shots. So to me, the biggest problem right now is that people are trying to shoot this arbitrary number of threes versus shooting quality threes. So basketball, when the game of basketball was first created, it was all about efficiency, sharing the basketball, people sacrificing themselves offensively as well as defensively. And you never set a number, okay, we want to take, even back then before the three-point line, or we want to take 20 jump shots or 20 layups or whatever the case may be. No, we want to take as many quality, good basketball shots as there are in the game. Look, if you're playing a game in today's game now that there were 40 quality threes in the game, have at it. Take them. Problem is, these teams that are shooting 40, 50 threes, probably 35 to 40% of them are poor shots. That's not good basketball to watch. That's not competitive basketball. And in terms of changing some of the rules, see, I believe people want to see back in the NBA a little bit of the struggle. Mm-hmm. You don't see as much struggle and competition and fight. And again, I'm talking to our roots now, Vinny, in Detroit.
Yes.
You know, that defense, that pushback, some little physicality. We like a little bit of that, but I think America at large likes to see struggle. That's why the NFL still is so big it is today. With the changes that they've tried to make and influence of analytics that's tried to come into their game, the core of the game has stayed the same. It's still blocking, tackling, hitting hard, playing the game, you know, taking what the defense gives you, being the more aggressive team, the more forceful team normally wins. And people, when they turn on sports competitions, especially team sports competitions, they want to see struggle and an overcoming.
Yes.
And so I think the league can find, and I believe that they will, an even line, if you will, okay, mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. where you can bring a couple things back to enhance the defense's ability to impact the game without taking away, like, you know, Victor Wembanyama and these guys that are coming out now. What Adam is talking about, though, is how these guys are being schooled and trained at a young age, though. See, that's what it's really getting to. So, look, Ralph Sampson, if you go back years ago, he had a lot of the skills that this kid has.
Yeah.
He wasn't, but he was in the era where it wasn't, you know,
you couldn't do all that.
Yeah, he wasn't shooting threes. But you go back and look at some of his film, he'd get that thing off the rim and he could push it and make plays on the break and all that. And if he was playing for coaches in that style, I'm sure he could, at that time, he could have developed a three-point shot. So a lot of it is in the development of the player. I want to see Victor Wembanyama do both. I don't want to see Victor Wembanyama at 7'5" take half his shots every night from the 3-point line. To me, that's putting him and his team at a competitive disadvantage. And so, again, it'll be interesting to see how this all turns out, but that's kind of my take on it right now.
Would you bring back, like, I do think that the corner three being shorter and teams sort of relocating for the corner three, would you eliminate the corners? Would you allow for more handshaking on the perimeter until you get to the free throw line or that? If you were commissioner for a day, if you were your good friend Joe Dumars in the league office, who was the czar of everything now, right?
Absolutely.
Would you, is there a rule change that you would say? Remember, they started taking away some of the James Harden, Trae Young, Luka Doncic sort of grifting, foul grifting a little bit. Would you bring, is the hand check the easiest thing? Is there no easy answer as far as sort of tilting the scales?
Yeah, the hand check can be dicey. I don't mind it because I grew up playing in the era that you had to learn to be able to navigate the court with hands on
you.
Yeah,
you get hit. No,
yeah, exactly.
You're putting it nicely. Scott's a little bit older than me, if y'all can probably see. You can tell. Scott's been a GM as long as I've been alive. But the name of the game for us growing up was get as close to the basket as possible. And if you were small, like me, I was a point guard, they would tell me, you come down here, you're going to get hit.
Oh, yeah.
And you couldn't be no punk.
You had
to play. So right. If you came down there, you had to position your body in such a way that maybe they didn't hit you in the – they wouldn't try to hit you in the face, but they would hit you. And you would have to accept that and take that. There isn't a – the game isn't as soft as people think it is, especially underneath the basket.
No.
Like, you see a lot of physicality. If you sit close to the floor, you see a lot of bumping and banging. Like, it's it's a lot of physical play down there. But there wasn't – going to the basket was like – it was a test of your manhood back then, Scott.
Yeah,
if you
no
got
question.
Past the hand check, that was a
an
accomplishment.
Absolutely. But let me say this, though. When you're talking about the hand check rule, tell me what can help – if they don't want to institute the hand check rule, let's start really, really legislating carrying of the basketball.
I knew you were going there.
So, if we want to keep hands off, let's stop Ja Morant and James Harden and LeBron James and all these guys for being able to literally pick the ball up and carry it to another spot. You can't guard that. That'd be difficult even with a hand check.
Yeah.
Let alone without being able to touch them. So that, to me, has to be looked at very closely in conjunction if you want to bring the hands back. And I will say this. Actually, you're right. I also worry about two again, and I'm not trying to encourage dirty play at all. But nowadays, when a guy goes to the basket and a defender goes to make a block on him, and that – the guy who's going to shoot the layup falls and hits the ground, it's an automatic review, or everybody says, oh, flagrant foul. And the guy can be making a basketball play. We're so quick to go to that. And so now you get people afraid because they may get a fine or start accumulating points of flagrant foul points that could lead to suspension. They won't go contest some of those shots with any kind of physicality. So
Scott, I got a hot take for you. I say we get rid of the damn review. For one, officials very rarely, and I know a lot of officials, and I think the good people and all sort of type of stuff, but I generally think when you go to the replay center, you're trying to find a way to make it so that you didn't make a mistake, by and large. Like on out of bounds plays or whatever, cool. But when it's about a foul, I've seen a play where guy goes to the basket, player goes up vertically, blocks the shot or whatever it is, right? And the official will say, challenge unsuccessful because player was touched by somebody else who wasn't even part of the play. Or made illegal contact. Well, that's not what we're adjudicating here. We're adjudicating whether the block shot should have been a block shot or not. And I feel like it becomes a matter of, let me make sure that I'm not wrong here. And it takes up sometimes 3 minutes and 15 different camera angles. And sometimes you don't have to see all that. And it slows the momentum of the game.
No question.
Scott, I'm just not a fan of it. I think sometimes mistakes are just made, and we live with the mistakes.
Yeah, look, what you're talking about, look, there's a human element to the game at all times. Mm-hmm. We live with the human element from the players and coaches.
Yeah.
Player may drop a pass out of bounds, miss an easy layup, you know, blow a defensive assignment, or a coach forgets that he has timeouts, or puts the wrong guy in at the wrong time. So this human element all around this game for the entire 48 minutes. So very good point. I agree that I understand wanting to get certain things right.
Right.
But to your point, I think it is starting to extend a little bit too far in terms of the amount of time being spent. And again, you're battling human nature when you say, like, officials want to be right. Okay, I made this call. It's not easy for them to go to the microphone and say, challenge was successful. I was wrong. We were wrong.
You know, in
live television. So
that's tough. No, but so, Scott, I gave you a chance to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Hardest trade you were ever involved in, whether you were the person pulling the trigger or heavily involved or whatever it was, even at a younger level, can you think of? Now, you've been a lot of places. You've been involved with a lot of things. Is there a trade that sticks out in your mind, whether it didn't work out or it did work out, that you were like, man, this is a tough, difficult trade to make?
The toughest thing, I got to go to my time in Detroit. And I got to go to the Chauncey Billups trade. And the reason, again, this is why I tell you the personal side of it for me. So I know Chauncey since he was 16 years old, 15. I recruited Chauncey as a high school player. I'm sorry. When we watched him at George Washington High School, knew his family. And what he meant to our team in Detroit, too, all that time, as you very well know, MVP of the finals, leader of that team. That's the difficult time to be able to, you know, say, hey, we're making this move to go in a different direction. That was tough. So that one stood out in terms of the emotional size of trades. Now, I've been part of bigger trades, which included a lot of bodies that were much more complex than that. So when you're talking about difficulty from a complexity standpoint, I remember the year I was in Seattle, I think at that time it was one of the largest trades. We traded with Cleveland. We had Wally Szczerbiak and Delonte West went somewhere. We took back three players. It was like 12 to 15 players that were part of this trade. So that was a very complex deal. It took a lot of time, but it wasn't as emotionally taxing.
Yeah.
If you will. And then I'd go back. And then the last one I would think of is when we were in Orlando, coming in the door, and the mandate was having to trade Dwight Howard, which was a four-team trade, which, again, took a lot of time and a lot of moving parts and much more complex than the Chauncey Billups one. But, again, just from the personal standpoint, and you know who I am as a person, and I remain close to Chauncey to this day. So that is that probably was the toughest one for me.
Yeah, for those who don't remember, Chauncey Billups being traded for Allen Iverson. In the start. It was in the start of the 08-09 season, maybe two or three games into.
Yeah, we were already playing games, yes. We were already playing games. So.
And that was after the run of six straight Eastern Conference Finals. You went to the finals twice. It had gotten a little bit stale, so you're trying to figure out a way to, how do we get cap space for the future? And maybe get one last run out of this.
Yes.
And it was the worst case scenario, pretty much. Allen Iverson came in. It was no longer the player that he was. It rejuvenated Chauncey Billups.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Pistons haven't won a playoff game since May 26, 2008.
Exactly.
That is a day that a few of my friends, Scott Perry, will text me every now and again And normally they text me on May 26th and say, Vinny, this is the last time we won a playoff game. You should write about that. Somebody needs to be held responsible for this.
Exactly.
So I'm holding Scott Perry responsible for this, y'all.
And I'm glad you added all the context, because obviously I just focused on the relationship with Chauncey, but to let all the listeners know who the trade was, it was for Allen Iverson, who's a Hall of Fame player, who was at the back end of his career as well, too. So both guards were a little bit older, but you know, the connection that Chauncey had with that team and that city and made it, you know, tougher. And but the points that you made before, trying to figure out one more way to energize what we had left, the group left, without handicapping ourselves long term, is what you have to do. And you know, you talk about being in the job of a general manager in the front office. Sometimes the best trade, and this trade didn't work out as well, but sometimes the best trades, though, that are made probably when they're not quite as popular to the public. But you as an executive or executive team see something that's going on currently and reading into the future and say, okay, let's get ahead of this before the bottom falls out and then you can't get anything back for a player. So that is a lot of times a thing. So again, I go ahead.
Scott, you worked in the city of NBA Apollo.
Look, exactly.
You what the
I like
Knicks,
that.
What
I
Knicks
like
fans'
that,
number one word was boo.
Exactly.
Scott never got booed, but other people there got booed.
Oh man! So, look, but I love my time in New York. I love the New York. There's nothing like, you know, other than home. You know, obviously, I'm gonna put Detroit to the side. You know, that's number one. But there's nothing like a New York fan base. I can tell you that right now. And I've been all around in terms of, I enjoyed that time, enjoyed the scrutiny.
They had you on the back page a couple times, Scott.
I know they did.
They had Scott on the back page of the New York Times. I'm like, New York Post. I'm like, why, like, Scott, fix your, like, why are you slouching in your seat? But that, ladies and gentlemen, is Scott Perry. Gave us so much front office intel today, man. Scott, really appreciate you. Sorry about your Pittsburgh Steelers going out. Hopefully, y'all can find a quarterback in the future.
We're going to find him. We're going to find him. And he might be on the roster right now. And I'll leave it at that.
Okay. That, ladies and gentlemen, is Scott Perry. Thanks to producer Brett and Dakota for the entire team that worked so hard behind the scenes on this show. I'll be back on Wednesday with another episode of The Good Word. Until then, everybody be safe.